You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Marie was a nice girl. I met her as the cook and resident small-time drug dealer of Le Bon Gray's, a tiny restaurant in downtown Lake Worth owned by a guy who had picked me off the streets, Emmanuel Baptiste. Marie had just gotten to America after her family raised enough money to have her smuggled from Haiti, following the attacks of Jimmy Barbecue Cherizer and the G9 Gang Confederation, where her father was tied up and burned to death. My name is John Rice, and this is the story of how I helped her. She was a breathtaking beauty. The ordinary-looking white man who helped bring her here also turned her out for prostitution, offering her money for sex and convincing her that she did not have a legitimate chance of getting a good job. She joined the cadre of girls who walked up and down downtown Lake Worth, waiting for men to buy them drinks, and it kept a roof over her head in an overpriced city and put food on her plate. I met her one night after some guy tried to have his way with her, and she didn't have enough money for dinner, so I made her some Haitian comfort food. Tassots cabri, heavily marinated fried goat, rice stained jet black with black mushrooms and legume, a stew of eggplant, cabbage, and other Caribbean vegetables and spices. I helped her with her English, and she helped me with my Creole. Eventually, it got to me helping her take some classes at the local community college, and Emmanuel helping her work towards citizenship. She wanted to open a nail salon and developed a crush on Ramon, the busboy at La Bonne Grace, who did not judge her for her situation. She didn't want to keep prostituting, and we almost had enough business to hire her as a waitress. She was afraid of someone named Cambrone, who I assumed to be the normal-looking guy I had seen her with, despite the Haitian name. She thought that he would leave her alone if she paid him a little more, and apparently he unexpectedly accepted. It was sweet to watch her and Ramon steal glances at each other. She was hopeful. I was looking forward to her stopping by for another free dinner, when suddenly she didn't. Her absence in Lake Worth was conspicuous, and I asked one of the other girls who she seemed to be friends with, and she said she also hadn't seen her. I filed a missing persons report, but the lady at PBSO shrugged helplessly at the situation. Marie had no one that knew her, only a single photo, no social security number, and little English. 2 weeks would go by until I accidentally sold a small amount of weed to the wrong dude, who didn't even seem that shady at first. 10 minutes later, the cops interrupted my frying of the plantains to place me under arrest. "You're screwed now, Mr. Rice," a particularly fat cop whispered in my ear. I wondered how he knew my name. After they put the cuffs on me, one of them slammed my head on the pavement to soften me up, and then stuffed an absurd-sized bag of crack in my back pocket, as if dealers were known for walking around with bricks sticking out. Right as the cop car was pulling away with me in the back, I saw Marie again. She was wearing her Creole head wrap, a dirty tank top, and a full-length skirt that dragged on the ground, the same outfit I had last seen her in. I saw her scream, but heard nothing. Despite having not seen her in less than a month, she had somehow become amazingly pregnant, There was no way it was only a single baby causing her stomach to protrude in such a way. I could tell something was horribly wrong and nearly broke my neck to get a better view as they hauled me away. Even aside from her bulging belly, what was much worse, however, was the fact that she seemed to float above the pavement, and a horrible multitude of arms and hands protruded from the hem of her skirt. She was shaking violently and looked enraged. It looked like she had to use incredible effort to raise a finger to point at us, as if to accuse us. The sight of Marie was horrifying, and I vomited immediately, much to the amusement of the police. As I went through the process of being framed for massive-scale drug dealing, it became clear that she was focused on me for some reason. Somehow she managed to follow me the entire way through the process without anyone else noticing that she was present. I tried to speak to her, as if hearing her speak might force the situation to make sense, despite her floating above the ground with hands desperately searching the ground beneath her. Finally, it came down to me being stuck in a room with two detectives. The fat cop, who I would learn was named Officer Townsend, an officer named Nicoletti, who seemed to just be there for support, and Marie, who stood silently in the corner, watching all of us. Marie seemed to be paying the most attention to Townsend as he sat down in front of me.
"So, Mr. Rice, looks like we got you for crack distribution. Not good, especially with that amount. It's your lucky day, though, because we need someone to make a buy off of another, even bigger jag-off. You buy that for us. You don't gotta worry about dropping soap. You don't do this for us. You keep up with that crazy act, and you're gonna be placed in a particularly bad part of jail."
He chuckled as he finished his pitch, projecting a deep smugness at the situation he placed me in. He spread his fingers over the manila folder as if to say, "Well, what did you expect?" And I had to wonder how conscious he was of his own wrongdoings. There is a natural trajectory of focusing on the flaws of people with issues like substance abuse or mental illness while ignoring the impact of their own unempathetic behavior that I had long gotten used to. I didn't respond, which he seems to correctly interpret as giving up.
"So, here's what you're gonna do."
He passed the manila folder to me and opened it, allowing me to see multiple pictures of the relatively mundane-looking white guy I had seen around Marie, and some paperwork that referred to the man as Jean-Claude Cambroni, Marie's pimp. On the surface, seemed to be the head of an organization known as the Front for Advancements and Progress of the Haitian Peoples.
"Yeah, I couldn't guess who this guy was originally, or why he decided to go with the Haitian shtick. But we're pretty sure he's a standard-issue white suburbanite,"
Nicoletti cut in with a chuckle. For once, I shared a drop of his sense of humor, but not enough for me to crack a smile. I had to read the paperwork with more interest to see why a white man might go by a Haitian name and work for a Haitian organization. Behind the documents of Mr. Cabrone, there was a printed paper detailing my confession as a massive cocaine trafficker. In the corner, Marie nodded angrily as I read the documents, holding her massive belly. I tried to focus on the paper, even as I noticed a teeming mass of things moving underneath her skirt.
"He sells fentanyl, cocaine, women, and the right person asks, children. We have an undercover who's arranged for someone, that'd be you, to make a purchase off of Mr. Cabrone. All you have to do is wear a wire and get him to agree to something he already thinks is a good idea."
Marie sneered in disgust at Officer Townsend. I wondered if she had a personal reason to dislike him. One way or the other, I knew what was going to happen to me if I didn't do what this pinnacle of corruption told me to do. I would get a sentence that wouldn't make sense. Officer Townsend smiled, fatly, widely, at me again while passing me a small electronic device.
Why don't you go ahead and try this one on? Just tape it to your torso under your shirt, sign on the dotted line on that third page, then you can go home safe tonight, and we'll pick you up tomorrow morning, when Mr. Cambrone is expecting you.
The feeling you get when you don't have a choice, but you can feel the water going above your head, is absolutely terrifying. I was simply in shock, and Marie only added to it. I nodded and did what I was told, even as Marie offered a malevolent smirk. I couldn't fathom why she would direct hatred towards me. When I looked up again after signing it, she was gone, and the fat man was moving around the table to unchain me and lead me out. A brusque lady wearing authority glasses at night told me that Townsend would be by my home late that next day to pick me up and go over what I was going to do and say before arranging for a taxi to take me home.
You're lucky you got caught when you did. Any other week you'd be getting plowed by some guy named Bubba right now, she said with a smug sense of authority.
I got in the cab and headed home. My apartment didn't feel the same as it did when I left during the morning. It didn't feel safe. I didn't feel as if I were isolated from the outside world. My mind kept bounding between the incredible injustice that fat piece of garbage had committed by framing me and the incredible fear I felt knowing that a cop, even a crooked one, probably wouldn't resort to framing someone unless there was something complicating the situation. And then, finally, to the ghost. Somehow, they all had something to do with each other. I was Googling the guy up, hoping to find someone connected to him. It occurred to me that the safest way through this situation might be to contact one of this guy's buddies and give them a heads up. That way, they would be more likely to simply turn me away. A quick search of FBI news bulletins gave me the names of four people who had managed to evade arrest during an operation supposedly connected to him. But further investigation showed that they were all dead. None of my friends knew who he was. We were all too low on the totem pole. Before I knew it, I had fallen down a hole trying to investigate the man. He had definitely been to Haiti at the very least, and I found newspaper clippings about him opening a series of medical clinics in Port-au-Prince. The next articles were about some of these clinics getting burned to the grounds by the locals. I had finally tracked down an email that seemed to be connected to the clinics, but as I was copying and pasting it into the address line of an email, when the screen on my computer suddenly went black, reflecting my face and Marie, who was now standing behind me. I shot up and flung myself against the wall, yelping in surprise. She pulled herself forward, the multitude of black hands that protruded from her long, dirty skirt, dripping blood as they grabbed the floor with determination. One by one, the hands rapidly pulled her towards me.
They did not kill me. They killed the children I would have had, and the children they would have had. He turned me into a weapon. You must carry this out,
she said with a thick Haitian accent.
Please, I don't understand.
In between blinks of my eyes, she had disappeared. It was at least 15 minutes before I got down from the wall. It took a much longer period of time before I was thinking clearly again. My friend was dead. Either Officer Townsend or Cambrone had killed her just as she was beginning to live. I couldn't imagine why or how she would be turned into a weapon, though. Eventually, I door-dashed a chuzo pan, or a shish kebab sandwich with crushed potato chips, quail eggs, and pineapple sauce from La Parada del Gordo in Palm Beach, and sat back down at my computer. It's much better than it sounds. Much like my interaction with the police, I knew that even though it was unarguably wrong that I was being put through this ordeal, that there was nothing I could realistically do about it. Either the police or Marie could just reach out and get me if they suspected I wasn't going to play ball, and I was beginning to feel like Marie was not willing or able to take no for an answer. She could easily hurt me, even kill me, by the looks of her new supernatural state. Besides that, at some level or another, there was a bit of truth to how the police at least viewed me. I was a small-time scumbag, and I already hated myself for it. My lifestyle had annihilated my life. I only worked at La Bonne Grey's because the owner, Emmanuel, took pity on me years ago. Most of the hobbies I once enjoyed had long been replaced with one terrible habit or another, and my return to school simply never happened. My guilt at wasted opportunities pointed me towards the belief that this was a fair fate for me. I took a ton of diphenhydramine along with my nightly drug regimen in an attempt to actually get sleep. Instead, I got a stressful high that gave me a deep grogginess that would end up lasting several days, making it feel like I hadn't really gotten high and never really came down. I had a tense sleepiness after two cups of coffee when Detective Wideload knocked on my door.
"Let's get this over with,"
he said, as he gruffly moved past me into my own home, carrying a large briefcase, as if it were nothing but a storage closet he and his buddies happened to need at the moment. The feeling of violation was terrible. First, he sat at my living room table and opened his briefcase, taking out what looked like a single gray AirPod. The meeting had been set for La Bonne Grey's. I felt massively violated again and knew that this essentially dragged Emmanuel into this mess as well. He went on to explain that he and several other officers would be near, but out of sight in case things went south.
"How many other informants have you guys sent after this guy?"
I heard my voice quake as I asked. He seemed to pause for a long moment, thinking about his response. Marie appeared suddenly, moving from my kitchen to my living room, the multitude of horrible arms seemingly pulling her aggressively forward, despite not touching the ground.
"A couple. They weren't able to get anything interesting recorded. We dropped their charges anyway, so don't worry about that. Just do the best that you can."
He didn't meet my eyes while saying this, instead focusing on the small cell phone-like device in front of him that he seemed to be pairing to the microphone. Marie stared at me, and I knew what had happened. She had been caught prostituting and sent to get information on Cambrone. I still didn't understand what she meant by becoming a weapon. Also, she was probably not Townsend's first victim, and clearly not Cambrone's. I resumed being dead silent, generally a good tactic with police.
"Even if they're looking for Bluetooth connections, they won't find it. It's something new. All we need is to get him to say anything at all about dealing. Even acknowledging the shipment you're buying should do the trick."
He sighed heavily and looked at the floor.
"I know that you're probably not in the mood to do me any favors, but if you can find out about the trafficking, the sex trafficking that is, you might end up saving a lot of innocent lives. We know for a fact that he's the one bringing girls in and selling them. We've rescued girls as far away as British Columbia, but no one has been willing to testify against him. It'd do a lot of good in the world if he landed behind bars."
I nodded and didn't say anything. Part of me could see that Townsend may have resorted to scumbaggery out of desperation against Cambrone, who I had no doubt was truly evil. Officer Townsend seemed dejected, nervous, and even more uptight. He packed his bags and motioned for me to follow him out to his car, an unmarked old Lincoln. We drove out to the bottom of Lake Worth, a part of Palm Beach County that had long ago been reserved for minorities. By this, I mean that its infrastructure had deliberately been allowed to degrade, its opportunities plucked and long transported elsewhere. Lately, gentrification had set in, with an extremely expensive area lying directly across some cliched train tracks. We passed check cashing stores, pawn shops, gun stores, and even occasional restaurants and normal businesses. Many of the buildings were painted in bright Caribbean colors that stood out even at night. But even normal family business in the bad part of Lake Worth are noticeable for the black metal bars over their windows, as well as the impossibly bright colors being painted on bare cinder block walls.
All right. We had our man set this up, and it was not easy to arrange. Rick is the undercover waiting for you. He's been working on this for a while now.
He motions to the side of the building that had become my second home, where a Hispanic man wearing a dirty Ramones t-shirt was waiting. Emmanuel would never allow a dirty vagrant to just hang out, and his being there added insults to the situation.
You don't have to act chummy with him,
Townsend said, nervously looking around.
Anything you can get him to say would be helpful. Here's the cash that you'll need for the buy. Good luck.
He handed me a giant stack of $100 bills, and I cracked the car door. I took a deep breath and braced myself for Florida's nightmare heat and humidity. I walked up to Rick, wondering what his real name might be.
For God's sake, what took you so long?
He spat out as I got near. I sensed his frustration was real and that I was being blamed for the delay. Even if I objected, it wouldn't mean anything, so I kept quiet.
I'm gonna wave you in, but there's no need for an introduction. He knows your name, and he's waiting for you.
Rick started with a tense tone as he opened the door for me. Since I had only just been arrested, I had to wonder if he had told this guy my name just last night, or if they had quietly been eyeing me as a potential informant the entire time. Either was possible, but I was beginning to suspect that one or both of them had considered me prior to my being arrested. I walked into the empty home and was greeted with the smell of frying plantains and curry still lingering in the air. Only Emmanuel was there, and he stared at the ground as he left the dining room. Mr. Cambrone smiled at me from his seat in the dead center of the restaurant, eating a massive plate of steak with a side of black rice in my home. He waved to the seat in front of me.
So, you're the latest to fall victim to their trap, he said as I sat down, smiling. I almost shot back up again, but he waved dismissively at my fearful reaction. His accent was clearly American, but he seemed to strain to use certain Haitian pronunciations. There's no need to worry, and not from me at least. I have no reason to harm you. The little machine they gave you will not betray anything to them. You're supposed to make a purchase of me, yes? At this point, he had strained his fake accents to a comical degree, sounding like a child's interpretation of a French villain. What he said was especially frightening, though. If this man could warp technology so that it did not work, what else could he do?
Yeah, I'm supposed to buy a big load of crack. I got the cash right here. What do you want me to do with it?
I took out the giant load of money as Mr. Cambrone laughed with what sounded like genuine entertainment.
I can tell you are not so excited about this task. This may work out for both of us, then. What I would like is that if you took care of a little something for me.
He reached under the table and pulled out a large, dark, colored piece of leather. A shadow moved from behind it, and I recognized Marie coming out from behind some pots and pans. She stared at the leather with disgust and rage.
This is a contract, a very special one, with the spirits of someone bound to it. I have already entered my part of the contract. I would like you to complete this. It requires a bit of Officer Townsend's sweat or saliva, and a bit of his blood. The more contact a person has with this contract, the more access the spirits will have to the person. The little contact we have had should be fine, but the amount Townsend will contribute will allow unlimited access to everything he has touched, even long ago, Once this contract is sealed in both ways, the spirit will be forced to do the most that it can, hopefully removing not only him, but any trace of his work from this world. Anything he is holding over both of us will disappear utterly. I gaped in awe as he passed me the item, which was covered in strange sigils. Marie looked at it with a pained expression, a heart bisected by a dotted line and surrounded by strange-looking crosses. I recognized the general Haitian design, a spiritual cosmogram whose history goes all the way back to pre-colonial Africa, but I could not guess at what I was looking at. Given the presence of Marie, however, I knew I had to take this seriously, and I could guess at its purpose. What am I supposed to do with his blood and saliva? Just get it and it's done? He smiled broadly that showed off his teeth, but displayed not a bit of mirth. All you have to do is touch each of them to this piece of leather, and it will be done. By accepting this, you accept your part in this contract. To be honest, I will not have a reason to harm you, as Officer Townsend is hoping, for I will never have to deal with you again. If you do not complete your part of the contract will punish you instead of him. I do not think that you will live very long without your skin. I could feel my gaping mouth open even further at this last note, but no sound came out. Marie stared at me with sorrow. I made a quiet note that Townsend may have been hoping that I would be killed. Of course, if you are not up for this, we could always simply kill you. I assure you it would be painless and nothing personal. I simply assumed you would prefer Officer Townsend's death to your own. He spread his hands broadly, as if to ask what I thought of the entire situation. Okay, I said, quietly. I'll do it. But they're listening to you right now, whatever that means to you. He smiled gregariously and handed me the leather. As I took it, I saw smoke rising from the strange letters, and the girl looming behind him smiled darkly. It is done, then. The contract is made. You may leave now. You'll find the officers won't be nearly as surprised as their lack of ability to listen to us as you may have imagined. He waved at me dismissively, and I felt my legs move shakily, dragging me away from the man who seemed able to offer certain death in a number of ways. I walked outside, my legs still feeling like I just had the most vicious leg day in the history of any gym, and noticed that Ricky wasn't even in sight. Down the road, Officer Townsend was no longer discreetly sitting in his unmarked vehicle. The headlights were on, and he was standing outside in his uniform, drinking a hot coffee in the unbelievable heat and humidity. I had the distinct impression that he was hoping Cambrone knew I was an informant. As I walked up, he shook his head in disappointment and got into his car, unenthusiastically motioning me to enter the passenger seat. So, he said a lot of weird stuff, huh? I asked. Part of me was still hoping that he would say it was all done and I could go home. Instead, he took a deep sigh and put the car into drive before I could even put my safety belt on. Something went wrong with the machine. He shook his head angrily. Did he take the money? Yeah, I said, wondering if I was going to go to jail right away, or if Townsend was telling the truth about not hearing the conversation. I didn't take it very seriously, though. It didn't give me anything. He even asked about you. His eyebrows raised in shock and didn't seem to go back down. You used my name? He asked, as I could hear anger and fear lurking in his voice. I didn't need to. He asked me about you the moment I sat down in front of him. Seemed like it was the only thing he found interesting, actually. This time there was no reaction at all, aside from a worried look on his face. He was simply dead silence for the rest of the trip. As we pulled up to the apartment, I noticed he was sweating slightly, but I didn't see any opportunity to collect any. I entered my run-down Floridian apartment in a daze, not even caring that I was tracking in dirt over the floor. I sat down on my couch and took the piece of leather out. Smoke rose softly from the strange patterns. I could see pores and even a hair follicle, and in one corner what may have been the edge of a navel. Marie had been skinned in order to make the contract. I began weeping hysterically.
"Both of them,"
whispered Marie from behind me. "I'm sorry this happened to you," I said, wiping snot off of my face, hoping she heard it before she disappeared.
"They pointed me at you. You would have stood in Cambrone's place. You must stop them. Once it is complete, I and the children I was supposed to have will end this,"
she said. When I looked behind me, I saw nothing there. I understood then that I was intended to be killed and likely to take the blame for something Cambrone had done. Marie didn't want to hurt me, but now that I was a part of that contract, she might not have any choice. I knew I had to go back to the restaurant and pray to God that Emmanuel hadn't cleaned up. I dashed to my clunky Plymouth Breeze and gunned it as hard as that piece of garbage would go. As I left, I saw Townsend waiting at the end of my block. He had been waiting to see if anyone would come to my apartment to kill me. When I got to the restaurant, it was a sad relief. Emmanuel hadn't even picked up the plate, probably having left as quickly as possible. I rushed to the plate and wiped the fork hard against the leather. Then I wiped the glass he had used, and smoke began to rise slowly from the leather. The diagrams seemed to change color, and then a myriad pattern of white dots began to fill in the bisected heart. I knew that, somehow, it had been done. I walked out and saw Townsend parked right where he had been waiting during the meeting. I didn't see any other cars or anyone at all nearby. I walked up to his car, my legs shaking violently. I knocked on his window, and he rolled it down.
"Yes?"
he asked, as if me approaching him was just stupid. "The prick left something behind on accident. It looks like his phone and some other stuff slid out of his pocket," I said. He looked instantly concerned and amused, getting out of the car to follow me. I opened the door of the restaurant and pointed to the table where Cambrone had sat. As he walked up to it, I took out the piece of leather. As he looked over the area in confusion, I took the steak knife Cambrone had used and rammed it into Townsend's fat neck, immediately clamping the leather to the wound. Right as he had dropped into the weaver stance and grabbed his weapon, I saw Marie behind him, coalescing into the world from what looked like behind a strange fog. Her hands wrapped around his eyes. He screamed for a moment and then fell silently backwards, where he seemed to fade away from this world into nothing. As I stood in horror, she turned to me, no longer appearing as a floating pregnant monster, but as the young woman I once knew.
"Thank you,"
she said, slowly evaporating into what looked like millions of colors of bright confetti that disappeared before it hit the ground. I fell to the ground, weeping. After some time, I got up, and there was no trace of blood. Cambrone was right about the contract and what it would do. Marie seemed to erase most of both men. I received a case from the police asking if I had seen Townsend, but they seemed to believe my lie and never called me again. No one ever asked about Cambrone, and the neighborhood was infinitely better for it.
I explained everything to Emmanuel, and he understood and accepted it. He, too, was horrified to learn of Marie's fate, and Ramon began weeping when we told him she was gone. I still had the money, which I split between investing into La Bongrée's as well as giving to several young immigrant girls. It's been several years now, and the restaurant is more popular than ever. We keep a small shrine to Marie to remember her and to thank her.